Hi, Marco Werman here. 2022 is just around the corner. Our team at The World has so many stories we plan to bring you in the new year. More stories from more places, more deep dive investigations, more music from around the globe, and more of the nuanced, human-centered international reporting you rely on. You've heard me say it here before, we just can't do it alone. We need your help. To everyone who has already donated to our fundraiser this year, thank you so much. Your support means everything. We are still short of our goal, but luckily our deadline has been extended. We have until December 31st to raise $67,000. As of right now, we're halfway there. If you haven't donated yet, please make your gift today to help power the world for another year. You can donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you, and now the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Presidents Biden and Putin are meeting tomorrow, and when diplomacy doesn't get Putin what he wants,
then what Putin has learned then is that he will do so through military force, and that's the risk. That's where we are today.
Also ahead, the military junta in Myanmar just sentenced Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi to 2 years in prison. She is 76, facing other charges, and possibly a century behind bars.
So who knows? It doesn't look like she'll be out walking the streets or playing any role in politics anytime soon, if ever again.
I'm Marco Werman, and we remember the multilingual, amorous side of the Beatles.
Tout à la fille, pour moi.
George Harrison in French. He loves all the girls, doesn't matter where they're from. Just wait till you hear the story behind the Beatles songs in German. All coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us this Monday. Today, the Biden administration fired a diplomatic shot across the bow at Beijing. The White House announced a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Winter Olympics in Beijing. The World's Bianca Hillier is here to explain what this means. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Marco.
So what exactly is a diplomatic boycott? Will this affect athletes?
No, it won't affect athletes at all. Team USA is still planning to send all of its athletes to Beijing in February. This is a boycott by government officials only. So usually the White House would send someone to represent the states, and this could be any number of people from the Secretary of State to the Vice President. In Tokyo this past summer, it was First Lady Jill Biden. But this time, nobody will go. And it's largely a symbolic gesture that can serve as an effective PR campaign, if you will, because it forces the public to consider the issues at hand and therefore pressure governments into action.
Right. And remind us what those issues are. Did the White House say what led to this decision?
Yeah, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said today this was because of China's, quote, ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang. She said while the athletes have the U.S. government's full support, the U.S. would not be contributing to the fanfare of the games. Here's Jen Psaki.
U.S. diplomatic or official representation would treat these games as business as usual in the face of the PRC's egregious human rights abuses and atrocities in Xinjiang. And we simply can't do that. As the president has told President Xi, standing up for human rights is in the DNA of Americans. We have a fundamental commitment to promoting human rights, and we feel strongly in our position, and we will continue to take actions to advance human rights in China and beyond.
The PRC, of course, is the People's Republic of China. Bianca, what is the precedent for this? Has the U.S. done this before, a diplomatic boycott?
So Democratic and Republican lawmakers have been calling for this diplomatic boycott for a long time, a few years in some cases, and it's really picked up over the past few months. But the U.S. hasn't made a move like this since 1980, when former President Jimmy Carter announced a boycott of the Moscow Olympics over the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan a year earlier. Now, that, Marco, was a full boycott, so no athletes attended the games either. But what's interesting interesting is that back then, more than 60 nations followed in that decision and also boycotted the Games. So now everyone's watching which countries, if any, will follow the U.S. with a diplomatic boycott of Beijing.
Yeah, we'll all be watching that closely to see who else joins this boycott. The World's Bianca Hillier covers the Olympics for us. Bianca, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Looking now at another diplomatic standoff, this one between Washington and Moscow. Tomorrow, President Biden is meeting virtually with Russian President Vladimir Putin. At the top of the agenda, the troubling buildup of Russian troops along its border with Ukraine. To understand what's at stake there, we turn to Andrea Kendall Taylor. She's the director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. So, Andrea, U.S. intelligence officials see the Russian troops amassed at the Ukrainian border as a potential planned invasion into Ukraine. What do you expect Biden will say to Putin in their meeting tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow will be a difficult discussion, and I think this is an opportunity for President Biden to make very clear what the United States is willing to do to deter any Russian escalation around Ukraine. Already in public statements, the United States has made clear that there would be significant costs to any Russian invasion or escalation. And so now he has to make those very concrete. So he's likely to raise U.S. sanctions. He will hopefully put some of those possibilities in the shop window, so to speak, in an effort to deter Putin. He will talk about continuing to provide lethal assistance to Ukraine to help them defend themselves. And I suspect they'll also talk about opportunities to renew the diplomatic piece of this. The United States has already called on Russia and Ukraine to come back to the table through the Minsk process.
And once that conversation starts between the two leaders, what do you think Putin is going to try to communicate to Biden?
Well, my understanding is that President Putin is likely to reiterate his calls for security guarantees for Russia. Over the last couple of months, Russia has really changed its red lines in Ukraine. It used to be that Russia didn't want to see Ukraine have NATO membership. So he will raise that. But he's also likely to raise other concerns, including the growing U.S. and NATO support to the Ukrainian military. So what he's likely to push on is to see the United States concede to Russia security guarantees that would keep Ukraine out of NATO and to reduce NATO and U.S. support for the Ukrainian military. So from Putin's perspective, things in Ukraine are not moving in a positive direction. And so he is now using military force to try to compel a conversation that might change that trajectory. And if he can't get what he is looking to accomplish through this diplomatic process, then what Putin has learned then is that he will do so through military force. And that's the risk. That's where we are today.
Well, as you said, if that happens, it would come with significant costs. You mentioned sanctions. I mean, sanctions have been laid on the Kremlin for the 2014 invasion into Donbass and eastern Ukraine and annexing Crimea. Those sanctions don't seem to have stopped Putin from serious saber-rattling if we look at the border right now. So if sanctions only work so far, what's left for the U.S. and the West to do if Putin does march into Ukraine?
I agree with you that sanctions so far have not caused Putin to shape his calculus. You know, that largely explains why we are here today. As you mentioned, Russia is already under U.S. sanctions. What we're hearing from the Biden administration is their intent to escalate those sanctions. At NATO last week, Secretary of State Antony Blinken talked about using economic measures that the United States has previously refrained from using in the past. But I agree that those sanctions alone are unlikely to change the calculus. And so what I would like to see is the administration to add to the conversation about costs by communicating to Putin that if Russia escalates, that the United States will have no choice but to revise our military posture in Europe. So to put new forces, return U.S. forces to Europe, to introduce either live fires or theater missile defense, to move forward with enhance forward presence permanently in the Baltics. I think that's one thing that could really get Putin's attention. Those are things that he might care about even more than he does Ukraine.
Is that kind of muscle flexing, though, the best pathway towards de-escalation?
That's the most important question. And I would say that those are things that we would want to communicate to Putin. Again, that if he escalates, the United States would have no choice but to move forward and change the security landscape in Europe in a way that Putin doesn't like. We should also be coupling that, as the administration is, with a diplomatic process. This administration has said that they will be willing to engage with Russia when it's in U.S. interest to do so. My expectation is even if we are confronting Russia over Ukraine, that we would still have these open lines of communication that are looking to put guardrails on other parts of the relationship.
Andrea Kendall-Taylor, the director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, previewing tomorrow's virtual meeting between President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Andrea, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
It's been more than 3 months since the fall of Kabul and the chaotic evacuation of tens of thousands of Afghans. Many have settled into new lives in America, but more than 40,000 Afghan evacuees remain at U.S. military bases. The World's Monica Campbell reports on the challenges facing this historic resettlement effort. And a quick note, the Afghans in this story who recently fled their country asked, for security reasons, to use only their first names.
When I call Sadiq, he steps outside to talk. It's too noisy inside.
I'm outside of my building. Like, there is a lot of people in my building, and it's really cold.
Sadiq and his family, including his four-month-old boy, are staying at the Fort McCoy Army Base in rural Wisconsin. Thousands of other Afghans are at the base, too. Sadiq says that, at first, U.S. officials told him,
you guys will be here for 15 days or 20 days.
Now it's been more than 3 months. It's unclear when they'll be told there's a home ready for them to settle into in the U.S.
Well, no idea. They're not telling us the date for leaving, you know.
That uncertainty is frustrating many Afghans, including a man named Jalil. He barely managed to flee Afghanistan after death threats from the Taliban for his work as an interpreter for the U.S. military. He and his family lived at the Fort Pickett base in Virginia for 3 months. He says he tried every day to find out when they would leave.
Take an appointment today and go tomorrow. Stay in line for hours and then come back with no answers.
It's a scenario advocates like Krish Omera Vignaraja warned the Biden administration about. She leads the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, a resettlement agency.
We had advocated to the administration beginning many months ago that an orderly evacuation would ensure that we had the lead time to make sure that we were prepared to welcome them upon their arrival on American soil.
Normally, resettlement agencies have weeks or months to prepare for a refugee family's arrival, to find an affordable home, get it furnished, scout out schools for the kids. The last-minute evacuation out of Kabul didn't allow for that. So now, Afghan families are spending long days at U.S. military barracks, coping with trauma and managing little kids. Spojmi Nasiri is an immigration lawyer offering legal aid to Afghans on several bases. She says some are so desperate to find jobs and start a new life that they're abandoning the bases.
They can leave if they want, but the biggest concern is that as more and more people leave the bases, we may potentially see those issues of homelessness, potentially, and that is a big concern.
Finding affordable housing for Afghan refugees is a huge challenge, and it helps explain why a lot of them have been stuck on military bases. Many are hoping to land in areas with big Afghan communities like California, Northern Virginia, and D.C. But those places tend to have really high rents, so Afghans are being resettled in parts of Missouri, Oklahoma, and Tennessee. Another challenge is finding landlords willing to rent without a credit check, says Vignaraja with the Lutheran Resettlement Agency.
Making sure that people understand that once they've arrived, they may not have a fixed income because they haven't gotten a job yet.
Getting a job is a top concern for Jalil, the Afghan who was at Fort Pickett in Virginia. He and his family were just released from the base, and they are now staying with his sister-in-law until an apartment turns up. He's in a desperate search for a job.
So now I'm here, so I have to support my family. There are other people like me on their own bases, and they left their families in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan's economy is collapsing, and mass starvation is a real threat right now. Jalil says his relatives are running out of food. He's anxious to start sending cash home. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Coming up, we zoom in on two active volcanoes, one in Indonesia, the other on Spain's Canary Islands, and what these volcanoes, probes to Earth's core, can tell us about the history of our planet.
Scientifically, they are this amazing source of information because they allow us to go deep into the Earth.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Negotiators are having a tough time breathing life back into the Iran nuclear deal. Since April, Iran and negotiators from several major powers have been revisiting the 2015 nuclear pact that President Donald Trump walked away from. prospects for a breakthrough dimmed after Iran elected a new hardline president in June. Now, indirect talks between Washington and Tehran appear to be fizzling. To find out why, we reached out to Hala Degress. She's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and curator of the newsletter The Iranist. So these indirect talks in Vienna began last week between Tehran and Washington, then broke off on Friday. They're picking up again this week. What has been Tehran's stance so far? What sort of deal are they hoping to make?
From the get-go, the new Ebrahim Raisi government has said that their main goal would be sanctions removal, and that's basically what they told us during these five-day talks. And for them, it means that they would like to see all sanctions removed and only little nuclear compliance. At least that's what we're hearing from some senior U.S. officials.
So the Iranians seem to be driving a hard bargain, especially around sanctions. What is Washington's position? Are they willing to give up all sanctions?
I think everyone's kind of scratching their heads here because these talks had adjourned in June right before the Iranian presidential election. And from our understanding, there were some proposals that the Iranians had agreed to. And so when they came back last week and sat down with the remaining signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, they came back with new proposals, something that surprised the remaining signatories. To them, and including the U.S., it seemed like they weren't very serious about talks because they had spent so many months under the Biden administration negotiating for something, only to actually start from zero, it seems like.
So at the same time, Iran is getting closer to being able to make a nuclear weapon, correct?
From what we're seeing, it is inching closer. It is not there yet, but there are cause for concern. The International Atomic Energy Agency continues to monitor some aspects of Iran's nuclear program, not all. At least one facility had its cameras damaged in a sabotage attack, and Iran refuses to let IAEA inspectors in to actually see what's going on.
So China, I see, sent a delegation to Vienna last week. What role is China playing?
China is actually one of the top oil buyers of Iran, and it really matters a lot for Iran what China has to say in this. They're no longer going to rely on the West for investment in their economy. The Chinese, they've also come out and said that they're not very content with Iran's handling with this new proposals. And my understanding, the United States has actually turned to China on this issue a bit and had discussions about Iran. When Xi Jinping and President Joe Biden spoke the other week, they did discuss the Iran nuclear agreement.
I mean, one narrative has been that a nuclear bomb would be a matter of pride for Iranians, like why should the U.S. and other countries have nukes but not Iran? Do you get that sense? I mean, if you had to guess, of 80 million Iranians, would that be the majority opinion?
That was a sentiment when I was growing up there, when President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad came out and said that Iran was starting to enrich uranium in 2006. That was the sentiment. I'd go everywhere and there would be signs that say nuclear energy is our right. You'd buy juice and it would say nuclear energy is our right as a sticker. So, I mean, that was the sentiment in 2006. And I think for a while it was there. But now we're in 2021, and I don't think that sentiment exists as much anymore. I think that when people are saying, well, we should go for the bomb, it's not a matter of pride necessarily at this point. It's a matter of what more can the West do to us? What more sanctions can they implement? We might as well go all the way. And so I think that's kind of where they're leaning towards.
So orange juice containers were used at one point for nuclear propaganda?
Yes, among other things. Lots of posters, too.
Wow. Hala Degress is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and curator of the newsletter The Iranist. Hala, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Turkey's national currency, the lira, is in crisis. In just 1 year, the average salaried worker there has seen the value of their wages cut in half compared with the U.S. dollar. This has pushed a lot of Turkish workers into alternate ways of protecting their savings. One of those ways is cryptocurrency. But as the world's Duri Baskaran reports from Istanbul, that carries its own risks.
This year, Turkey got really into crypto.
Cengiz, BTC Türk'le Bitcoin alıp satmak ne kadar kolay?
There are ads at the airport, ads on the metro. BTC Türk, the country's largest crypto platform, sponsors national sports teams. On YouTube, Turkish enthusiasts dole out advice. Setting up live streams where investors can ask questions in real time. In downtown Istanbul, thousands have attended blockchain trainings led by Ahmet Usta, an author and cryptocurrency expert.
In all of my trainings, I strongly advise participants to invest in cryptocurrencies. However, I state that they must follow two basic rules while doing so. First, they should take as much risk as they can manage and never invest money that they will later regret losing.
Do not become overexcited, he says. In the first year of the pandemic, the number of Turkish crypto traders doubled to 5 million. And the reason, analysts say, has less to do with an affinity for tech and more to do with the spiraling Turkish economy. Enes Ozkan is an economist at Istanbul University, working on the behavioral economics of cryptocurrency.
They are seeing a hope in cryptocurrency market.
Last month, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan insisted that the central bank cut interest rates against the advice of most economists. The lira tanked. One U.S. dollar is now worth more than 13 Turkish lira, twice what it was a year ago. It's like watching the value of your savings account get cut in half, almost overnight. Ozkan says historically, many Turkish people have chosen not to keep their savings in lira, opting instead for bank accounts backed by U.S. dollars, buying gold, or investing in real estate. But in this economy, a lot of people can't buy property. It's just unaffordable. Bitcoin is easier.
If you gain money in cryptocurrencies, you gain big amount of money. But opposite of this is also truth.
According to Chainalysis, a New York-based crypto consultancy firm, Turkey has the highest transaction volume for cryptocurrency in the Middle East. But it's volatile. Over the weekend, Bitcoin, the largest cryptocurrency in the world, lost a fifth of its value, shaking investors and liquidating nearly $1 billion.
It's a casino kind of operation. So they're not really investments. They're speculative assets.
Steve Hanke is a professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University's Cato Institute and the founder of the Troubled Currencies Project. He says many countries with high inflation rates are showing a growing interest in cryptocurrency, but he thinks that's misguided.
With cryptos, there's no fundamental value. The fundamental value is zero. They're just for speculation.
But at least some Turks say they're happy with their cryptocurrency investments. This one asked not to share his name because criticizing the economy in Turkey can bring legal trouble. Everyone's going into cryptocurrency, he says, because of the economic crisis. But he keeps his investments small and puts 10% of his crypto earnings into his savings account every month. This way, he believes he's protecting himself from losing too much on a bad Bitcoin day. I don't want to wait until 2050 and say I knew about cryptocurrency but didn't do anything about it, he says. As Turkey's economy continues to worsen, others are following suit. For The World, I'm Derya Buscarin in Istanbul.
You're listening to The World. Encanto is the story of a family in Colombia with magical powers.
Every member of our family was given their own magical gift.
The animated film is a hit in Bogota.
Normalmente lo que muestran de Colombia son los
This moviegoer says typical Hollywood fare shows Colombia's negative side. She loved Disney's rendition. She even spotted the cheesy arepas. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. She is a Nobel Prize winner and for a long time an international symbol for democracy and human rights. But today, Aung San Suu Kyi was sentenced to 2 years in prison by the military regime in Myanmar. She's been in detention since February when Myanmar's military seized control of the country. Suu Kyi is being charged with incitement and violating COVID-19 restrictions, charges that are widely seen as a pretext to locking her up. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the story and joins us from Bangkok. Remind us, first of all, Patrick, of the role Aung San Suu Kyi played in the previous government and why the military would target her in this way.
Before the coup, she and her political party were sharing power with the military. Essentially, her party would sweep every election, but the military had baked into the system that they had a lot of say as well. Long story short, she and her party, seeing themselves as rightful leaders, would push back against the military a little bit. And by February, the military just threw a tantrum, flipped the table over and said, no more sharing. We run everything now. So this trial, it really just gives a legal justification or cover to get rid of her. She's actually facing a dozen criminal charges. There's corruption charges in there, violating state secrets, all sorts of things. And if you add all of those charges up, she is facing 100 years in prison. So I just have to say, this has not been a normal trial. It's closed to the public. and some of the charges don't make that much sense. Frankly, nothing has really been normal in Myanmar since the military takeover.
Right. Aung San Suu Kyi is revered by much of the population in Myanmar. What does a 2-year prison sentence mean for her political career?
In effect, it means that her political career is over. Aung San Suu Kyi is 76 years old, so unless somebody breaks her out of detention, she could be silenced forever. What she has been reduced to, Marco, now is just an inspirational figure, not any type of decision maker. Just yesterday in Yangon, which is the main city in Myanmar, some protesters came out with pictures of Aung San Suu Kyi, her supporters, in advance of this sentencing. They did a quick little peace march down the street, chanting as they marched down the street. And then what happens next, we can't really play it because it's so disturbing. A military truck just plows into these young protesters. Soldiers hop out of the truck and start shooting at them. And in total, at least 5 people were killed. So this is how the regime regards any criticism of their power.
Yeah, that is really disturbing. I'm just curious, what has been the reaction to that event today?
Honestly, Marco, from the people I've talked to in Myanmar, they expect things like that to happen at this point. The military has been so violent, has killed well over 1,000 people since the coup. I can sit here and name dozens of things that are just like that, and so people have come to expect it.
There is a pro-democracy movement in Myanmar. How much does Aung San Suu Kyi's imprisonment matter to the people who are standing up to the military junta?
I think increasingly it doesn't matter as much. She has actually been cut off from the world in detention, so she can't even talk to the people that are out there in the streets. And increasingly, Marco, the masses are turning to armed struggle. They've formed a revolutionary government from the remnants of her party, the members of the party that did not get locked up and are in hiding. And people are shooting back at the military. And if you know anything about Aung San Suu Kyi, she has also always been this symbol of peaceful dissidents, you know, backed by the United States. She won a Nobel Peace Prize for standing up to the army. Of course, she later disgraced herself by making nice with the military and helping them cover up ethnic cleansing against the Rohingya, this Muslim group. A lot of good that did her because, as you see, they've turned on her in the end. So now we've entered this new chapter, a more youth-led chapter with people saying she was wrong to ever trust the military and the only path to democracy is to destroy the military by fighting back with violence. And that's what they're trying to do.
So if the military in Myanmar can lock away the most prominent opposition figure there, what's next for the pro-democracy movement?
More civil war, more urban guerrilla warfare. This new breed of revolutionaries, you know, they will blow up a police station or assassinate regime officials. I mean, it's really full on. That's just in the towns and cities. In the borderlands of Myanmar, you have indigenous people who've been fighting for autonomy for decades, and now they're joining forces with people who just last year were working in an office or going to rebel groups and saying, can I get a gun? Let's do this. Even this week, it started to look like they're starting to carve out a new liberated area in the plains, in the northern plains of the country. So that's a development. Whether or not this revolution will win or not, nobody knows, but the only clear path Aung San Suu Kyi has to being a part of it would be if the military were toppled. And I wasn't kidding when I said if somebody breaks her out of detention. And then presumably there would be another election because they claim to stand up for democracy, and then she'd have to win all over again. But we're getting super speculative. You know, most people at this point in Myanmar, Marco, are just trying to survive.
Patrick Nguyen is the world's Southeast Asia correspondent. Patrick, thanks as always.
Thanks, Marco.
The latest Disney animated film, Encanto, has led the box office in the U.S. since it opened Thanksgiving weekend. The film is set in Colombia, and the story turns around Colombian culture and music. The movie, not surprisingly, is drawing huge audiences there, too. As Manuel Rueda reports from Bogota, children, of course, are packing the theaters, but also adults who are seeing in Encanto a different approach to how their country is portrayed.
At a movie theater in Bogota, couples giggle as the Disney movie Encanto finishes and the credits appear on screen. Some have tears in their eyes. Most of the people at this weeknight showing are adults who are on dates or hanging out with friends. They've come to the movie for its entertaining plot, but also because they wanted to see how Disney depicts Colombia.
La fisionomía como de los protagonistas es muy relacionada a...
I loved how they show the racial diversity of Colombian people, says Julián Hidárraga, a commodities trader who went to watch the film. It's nice how they show our Latin beauty.
Normalmente lo que muestran de Colombia son los aspectos.
Normally, what they show about Colombia are negative things like the drug trade, says Sierra de Luque. Here, it's the opposite. I mean, they have cheese arepas and the dancing donkeys. It was great. Encanto is set in the lush mountains of central Colombia and features Mirabel, a 15-year-old with round glasses who's having a tough time fitting in with her family.
Morning, abuelo!
Everyone in Mirabel's family has a magic power, like a cousin who's able to speak with animals.
I understand you.
Or an older sister who has unlimited strength and can move buildings or carry donkeys on her shoulders. But Mirabel has no gift that is evident, and she must find her purpose while navigating her family's expectations.
You are a wonder, Mirabel Madrigal. Whatever gift awaits will be just as special as you.
It may sound like typical Disney material, but the movie has been a huge hit in Colombia, a country that's not used to appearing on Disney films. More than 1.6 million tickets were sold for Encanto during its first week in Colombian movie theaters, and distributors said that by the end of last week, 5% of the country's population had seen the film. Some movie theaters in Bogotá show Encanto every half hour. Lisandro Duque, a filmmaker in Bogotá, says that the movie has been embraced so warmly because it provides Colombian audiences with a reason to feel good about their country and have some kind of redemption. That's because in Hollywood films and streaming platforms like Netflix, Colombia is mostly depicted as a backwards and violent place, rife with drug violence. Like in Narcos, where Colombia's history is told through the eyes of an American cop that arrives in the country to fight corrupt police and take down the world's biggest drug dealer.
We were witnessing the formation of the famed Medellin cartel. There was Jose Rodriguez Gacha. And last but not least, Pablo Escobar.
Look, that's Pablo.
Then there's Blow, starring Johnny Depp, where Colombia's capital city is depicted as a town with unpaved roads where chickens are running around between jeeps. Those narco films were bothering Colombians a lot, Duque says. They didn't want them to become a popular genre, like Westerns. Encanto, on the other hand, shows Colombia as a country teeming with biodiversity and festive music, where different ethnic groups live together in harmony. Duque says that the country is portrayed in a folksy and antiquated fashion, pointing out that the characters in Encanto walk around in ponchos and wear clothes from the 1920s. So the movie is not really portraying modern-day Colombia, where even in rural towns you're more likely to see motorcycles than donkeys. But Colombia's government has also embraced Encanto, and is using the film to promote tourism and investment.
I grow rows and rows of roses, Flor de Mayo, by the Mayo.
Colombian embassies around the world have organized special screenings of Encanto to show the film to tour operators and journalists. In South Korea, the Colombian embassy even sent a truckload of flowers to the movie's opening night. Flowers are one of Colombia's main exports. Gilberto Salcedo is with ProColombia, the government agency in charge of tourism and investment.
Precisamente para que la gente conozca de primera mano todo lo que el país tiene para ofrecer.
We want people to have first-hand knowledge of everything our country has to offer, he says. Disney has a huge reach, so the fact that it featured Colombia in its latest film will inevitably increase interest in our country. Even local governments have jumped on the Encanto bandwagon. The province of Quindío, home to the tall palm trees in the movie, is putting up billboards of the film near its tourist attractions.
Two oruguitas against the weather. The wind grows colder, but they're together.
For Colombia, it's been a rough year, marked by violent street protests and growing rates of poverty because of the pandemic. So a movie like Encanto that shows Colombia as a magical place full of possibilities is a welcome change for local audiences. And it could help the country to improve its image. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogotá.
Just on the other side, trust they'll be there. Start to prepare the way for tomorrow. Oh,
This weekend in Indonesia, motorbikes were on the move as people fled a towering gray cloud of ash and gas erupting from a volcano. This was on the very populated island of Java. The volcano Semeru erupted and has now killed at least 22 people. Dozens more with severe burns have been hospitalized. Many people are still missing. Meantime, halfway around the world in Spain's Canary Islands, another volcano has been spewing lava and ash for more than 11 weeks. Cumbre Vieja, the volcano on the island of La Palma, shows no signs of growing dormant. To talk about what's going on, we reached out to Esteban Gazelle, a volcano expert at Cornell University in upstate New York. So, two big volcanoes here to discuss, Esteban. Let's first look at the eruption over the weekend in Java. We know there was an increase in volcanic activity this week, but the eruption on Java was not predicted by Indonesia's main volcanology center. Is that a relatively common thing, that deadly eruptions can come so suddenly?
The problem with science, especially in the earth sciences, is that we're not really in the business of prediction itself. We can evaluate or do an assessment of what are going to be the chances that there is a new replenishment of magma that may trigger an eruption. But in order to do this the most precise way, volcanoes need to be incredibly instrumented. We need to put a lot of technology in those volcanoes, and that technology costs a lot of money. So as a community, we're working to try to have a system that more and more volcanoes get instrumented to avoid a crisis like this.
Is there a disparity in how well volcanoes are instrumented in Indonesia compared to more wealthy places like Hawaii or the Canary Islands, which is a Spanish territory?
The actual numbers is something not that I don't handle. I know the colleagues in Indonesia have been working to do the best they can with their monitoring stations, but this is a problem that is global. Even in the United States, we don't have all our volcanoes monitored.
So there are these obvious challenges to predicting a recurrence of magma. Is there any way to predict how long this eruption will last? Like, what indicators are you watching?
At this point, we can monitor nature the same way that you are monitoring a patient that is sick. You can look at their signs. You can look at their chemistry. You can do analysis of what is going on. But the exact moment a patient will die or will successfully defeat the disease is almost unpredictable. And when you're dealing with nature, you're dealing with so many factors that, again, like making a prediction is incredibly difficult.
Mm. Okay, Esteban, let's pivot to the other side of the globe, La Palma and the Canary Islands. You were there about a month ago for your research. How close to Cumbre Vieja, the volcano, were you able to get, and what did you see?
We were within 1 kilometer from all sorts of different parts of the volcano because we were there making observation and collecting samples. So we were making measurements and collecting samples all the way from the material that was falling in our heads to nanoparticles, particles that you don't see, but those are the ones that are going to be distributed globally. The irony here is that volcanoes are our probes to the deep earth. Volcanoes are really these locations on earth where energy and mass are transferred to the surface. So volcanoes bring information and secrets to the origin and evolution of the Earth and even the solar system. Scientifically, they are this amazing source of information because they allow us to go deep into the Earth.
So is it possible, Esteban, that research like yours can actually help volcano monitoring around the world or even prevent the kinds of deaths Indonesia witnessed over the weekend?
Well, that's our goal. In the end, the most volcanoes we study, the most we understand the system, the most volcanoes we monitor, that means that we have a lot of technology embedded in these volcanoes, the best we're going to do to avoid tragedies in the future. That's the deep motivation here. We have history of volcanoes not erupting in 500 years, and then they erupt. That's why monitoring is fundamental. And our community really, one of the big initiatives that we have been trying to do, and I have been involved, is an initiative to basically instrument every active volcano in planet Earth.
How far along is that effort?
Well, we have submitted a couple of proposals, but there is an economic tag to this. This is going to be an expensive project, but if you compare this to the big, for example, the big telescopes, planetary missions that we send probes to other planets, is a fraction of the price of those really big programs. And it's an initiative that will completely transform the scenario here, if we can monitor every volcano in planet Earth in real time, the chances that we understand the system better with the goal to eventually prevent more the loss of life are going to be much higher.
Esteban Gazelle is a geochemist with Cornell University in New York. He's been speaking with us from Ithaca. Thank you very much. Great to meet you, Esteban.
Thank you.
File this one under Finders Keepers. A mountain climber on France's Mont Blanc will get to keep some of the emeralds, rubies, and sapphires he found buried in a glacier there. The jewels likely originated from a plane crash on the iconic mountain, a 1966 flight from Mumbai to New York. The jewels were buried in a metal box when a mountaineer stumbled across the debris. He turned them in. 8 years after that discovery, the mayor of Chamonix, France, announced the gemstones will be shared between the climber and local authorities. Their value, about $338,000. The mayor told the French news agency the climber had integrity for turning in the gems. So maybe finders keepers when the finders do the right thing. It can be notoriously difficult to get information from some of India's border states. The Indian state of Nagaland, the farthest eastern state in India, abuts Myanmar. Journalists need to be accredited to work there, which makes it hard to get out information. But this weekend, news did get out after Indian security forces allegedly killed what appears to be at least a dozen people. It looked like a crackdown gone wrong. Maritan Odio is an online editor with the news site We the Nagas. He joins us from Dimapur, Nagaland, where he's been speaking with people about the massacre on Saturday and the reaction. Maritan, what exactly happened this weekend? Why did violence suddenly erupt?
So what happened was that on the evening of 4th of December at around 4 p.m., eight of the villagers, they were returning from coal mining work in a pickup truck. And they were fired upon apparently without any attempt of identification. And out of the eight civilians, eight of them were killed on the spot and two critically injured.
And after the primary incident, apparently two more people were allegedly killed in more violence. Is that correct?
Due to this incident, the public, they were outraged. And on the next day, they started destroying the properties. The army personnel, they fired on the public, and two more people were killed in the incident.
So let's back up for a moment here, Maritan. What's been going on in Nagaland historically that's led to such a strong Indian security presence?
Before, Nagaland was under the invasion of the British forces. So when the Britishers left, the state of Nagaland, it was not created. So the Nagaland state has been demanding for different country from India.
So as to the first incident, how is the Indian military justifying this?
The Indian military, they are saying that they have gave a press report saying that they have regretted the incident. And they are justifying saying that it was a case of mistaken identity, saying that they have received a special intelligence report saying that some of the insurgents will be moving towards that site. So unfortunately, the innocent villagers came towards that way and they were killed in the unfortunate incident.
And yet people in Nagaland are really hard-pressed, I understand, to see this as an accident or an intelligence failure. I mean, experts say it's rare to see insurgents traveling in an open pickup truck, and one can imagine visually there's a clear difference between day laborers and fighters. Is the Indian army under pressure to explain further what went wrong?
The justification which they are giving does not make any sense because they have all the facilities at their disposal to understand and to know who the insurgents are and who the laborers are. They have also justified saying that they were asked to stop when the vehicle came. But when the vehicle did not stop, they started firing. That is the justification that they gave. They have given further justification saying that it was an act of self-defense, which does not make any sense because when the pickup itself is fleeing from the spot, how can they justify saying that they acted in self-defense? According to the Armed Force Special Power Act, they have given full power to the armed forces, whereby they can fire upon any people without any warning if they think that they are acting in contravention of a law.
The Armed Forces Special Powers Act that you're referencing there, it is Delhi's tool of control in Nagaland, it seems. The chief minister in Nagaland, Nephew Rio, he said that it's time for the government to withdraw the AFSPA. I mean, will Parliament in Delhi listen to him?
That will solely depend on the central government, whether they listen or not. But it is very unlikely that they will withdraw this or they will repeal this dangerous act.
So, Maritone, as I said, it's really hard to get information and news out of Nagaland. There are just really tight restrictions on journalists there. But how exactly did this news get through?
Everyone has become a citizen journalist. Whatever happens around them, they just, take a report on that. They click a picture and they send it to us. And that is how it gets the attention of the national media.
Maritone Odio is an online news editor in India with the site We the Nagas, sharing with us what he's been hearing from people in the far eastern Indian state of Nagaland about the alleged killing of at least a dozen people by Indian security forces there over the weekend. Maritone, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
A lot of people are talking about Get Back, the epic Peter Jackson-produced Beatles documentary exploring the final music the band made in 1969. We wanted to drop this note about the band's start and how Beatlemania got some in the music industry thinking they could translate the magic in the Beatles' lyrics.
You could tell by the look and certainly by the sound of the crowd that this was no ordinary departure from London Airport. We'll say it was. The Beatles were on their way to America.
February 7th, 1964, Pan Am Flight 101 was about to take off for New York and introduce a new continent to the Beatles. Just days before, the band had completed a run of 19 dates at the Olympia in Paris. The French relationship with the English, they've long called them les roast beef, is oft described as love-hate, but it was all love for the Beatles, and the lads worked it to the hilt with the French press.
John, quand pensez-vous retourner en France?
Nous ne savons pas pour le moment.
George, vous préférez les filles françaises ou les filles américaines?
Toutes les filles pour moi.
George Harrison, they're saying, he likes all girls, regardless of nationality. The band was camped in Paris at the swanky Georges V Hotel and was getting pestered by the West German branch of their record label, EMI, to go to a Paris studio to record their two most famous songs, but in German. I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You. Not one of the Fab Four wanted to do it. Producer George Martin persisted, and they finally gave in, even working with a German translator the label dispatched to Paris from Cologne. According to the EMI recording notes, George Martin says that the morning of the session, the band did not show up at the studio. When he went to fetch them at the hotel with the German speaking coach, he found them drinking tea. They had changed their minds about singing, Komm, gib mir deine Hand. Martin was furious and badgered them into a taxi cab and over to the studio. They even redid the hand claps. Oh, come up, come to me. Come give me deine Hand. George Martin admitted later that the lads were right. It wasn't necessary to do those German versions, he writes, but they did a good job. Norman Smith, the engineer at the time, says they were extremely pleased to get it over with. We all were. So add to their immense musical talent the Beatles' ability to speak and sing in French and German. Ooh-oohs, that's understood by all. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.